like a fool. Tell me, what did I do wrong? Everybody used to love my songs. Now I'm just a teacher mom. What a big mistake, my taking in an egg killed my rock and roll and dreams. The boy belongs in big tall trees, and me, well, I belong at MSG.
Decided that we'd take it in.
Forgetting all our dreams, we took them and it seemed we had a little family. For $700 a week I teach, and it pays for all the food chain.
I don't know if you would categorize it as a rock opera or a Broadway show brought to rock and roll, but nonetheless, Go to School by Lemon Twigs is definitely a unique piece of work. And it is the Lemon Twigs, by the way. And speaking of a unique piece of work in the most honest way, some artist conversations are easier than others. And, well, let me tell you, this is just another Men of Sunday, where in hour number one, we have conversations with rock and rollers of note and have them build us a musical sandwich. And then in hour number two, we play new melodic rock and roll. I first saw the Lemon Twigs at South by Southwest at a showcase for the label, I don't know, was it 2 years ago? I guess it was 2 years ago. And so, back to the story. The Daddario brothers, who are the Lemon Twigs, I missed a text from their manager just before entering the venue to have a conversation with them, and discovered that they don't have conversations together. Now, they're brothers, they're family, they write together, obviously, well, sort of, kinda, and they perform together, but they do not have conversations together. And I pushed it hard, and, well, you'll see, or actually you'll hear, my conversation with one of them, because that's the only way they do it. Hi there, it's Dennis the Menace. It's a great conversation, though, once we got it going and once we got some things understood. So let's head for a conversation with either the Lemon or the Twig of the Lemon Twigs here on Just Another Menace Sunday.
Would you introduce yourself, please?
I'm Brian Daddario. That's my name.
And you're one half of
the Lemon Twigs.
And you see, now we are going to do something that you don't do. We're going to explain to the audience why you are representing the Lemon Twigs versus both of you representing the Lemon Twigs. So they don't think that, like, I showed up and you thought I was just the biggest jerk that ever lived.
No, of course, I still don't.
I mean, I might be, but go ahead.
Well, you never really know someone, do you?
No, you don't.
We like to do interviews separately so we can get our singular ideas across and not be represented by what each other likes.
So I like revisionist history because it's a lot more fun. So we got you Long Island. You're obviously brothers. It's the sophomore album. You defy genres. You've played major festivals and now you're on tour behind the second album. What are you amazed that no one's ever asked you yet? You've been asked a zillion things.
I don't know. I'm not too creative, you know? It's kind of hard to, like,
what would you like to be asked? Like, if I could ask you anything right now, what would you like to be asked? It's not a test question.
I know, it's just that there's nothing
I'd
like to be
asked. Well, if there's nothing, there's nothing.
Yeah.
Are you saying that after all of this?
I like when people tell me things about stuff that I like, music that I like that I maybe haven't heard before.
So, age 7 community theater, is that about where?
Yeah, my mom got kind of back into theater.
Right, community theater.
That.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, community theater, and she just asked us if we wanted to.
I was age 6, I was one of the newsboys in Gypsy, interestingly enough. But, and so where was the segue from community theater and this kind of like, oh, mom's bringing us along and we're playing parts, to like, wait a minute, we're awfully young and we have an agent and we're traveling from Long Island, I know how to say Long Island because, you know, Queens is right next door, to New York City and actually doing this legit.
It was it was kind of quick. I know that I was 7 doing community theater, and I think within a year or 2 years, actually more like a year, someone who had our first agent was in the audience at the theater. And so they introduced us. And then it was probably like a year or two of auditioning before we got our first, or before I got my first major part.
And I don't mean this in an insulting way. I mean this in a funny way. What do you think? I mean, 8 zillion kids in the world from New York, you know, might make it on stage. Their mom knows somebody, whatever. What do you think the agents saw in you and your brother?
Well, because we had kind of an edge because music was our first love even then. So we really weren't, we weren't nervous ever. It was always the level of just doing it for fun or just because it was an opportunity that was available. It was always that level as opposed to when kids get a lot of pressure on them, especially from their parents, to really like do this thing, and then they come in totally
memorized. Right,
the stage memorized.
Mom, the stage dad. Yeah,
yeah, and there were so many like kids that would walk in and just be like, know everybody's, know all the casting directors' like names, and like so over the top. And we never memorized anything, and we were just, we didn't really let on that we were super, you know, eager. So I think that gave us a leg, because it set us apart from the kids that we were auditioning with. When we got older, that doesn't really work as well to not really care.
You're too self-aware by then.
Well, there's that, and then there's also like, it, you have to be prepared. I mean, you're talking about real acting when you get...
Yeah, you can't be innocent anymore.
Yeah.
So when you went, quote, legit, did the high school musicals kind of go out the window?
Or did they did. We were just talking about this the other
day. It's kind of interesting,
day.
Though, right?
Because we... I never really wanted to revisit it too much because I was so focused on what we were doing musically. Yeah. But Michael talked about how he actually had... He wanted to do the high school musicals after he had done this professional stuff. But he felt like...
The kids, you know, are
the kids.
Look at you.
The kids are gonna be like, "What are you? What are you
What's
doing?"
Wrong with you?
You know, or
yeah.
like, think like, "Didn't you already have like this is all we have?" Or something like
but
that.
But half the kids
or,
who do high school musicals don't have aspirations of having a career in this stuff either. But let's talk about this thing. This chimpanzee adopted by humans, raised as a boy, finds redemption. You know, the log line on it. I'm not going to do the typical thing here. We can talk about, I mean, we can go into the story, but I'm just curious, how did you and your brother sit down and conjure this up? What did you, how, like you're sitting and you're saying, okay, sophomore album, you know, we have to deliver something to the label. We've been touring.
Well, we didn't really think about any of that stuff because it was just, I mean, we were conceptualizing it when we were touring the first record.
Who started? I mean, how do you
I think that, well, I think the song Queen of My School came first. That was initially written as a standalone song that wasn't part of anything. And that was just introducing the kind of common thing of like a nerd and going with the like most popular girl or something. And then she like rejects him at the end of the song. And then, and I was writing a lot of songs that had to do with what became like the themes of the record, which was more like realizing at a certain point that you've kind of lost a certain degree of innocence and feeling like what humans kind of have the, we kind of look at it as like a positive thing to be able to break things down and analyze things and be very critical, which it is in some cases, but in terms of like actually enjoying life, you can lead yourself to just like finding something wrong with every aspect of your life, which isn't necessarily truthful. I mean, if you look at animals, you kind of would think that some of them are like very instinctual and don't experience a certain degree of suffering that we experience. But you know, if you look at like an animal in the wild or something, it's like it, for them to, I don't know. It's not that important to the story, how truthful it is, because it's kind of a
I'm not
fantasy.
Sure high school students are any different than animals in the wild, though.
That might be true. But the crux of the story is that, you know, he's the chimp is more connected to his intuition because he's got more of a his mind on
because
he acts on instinct, basically.
Right. But also because he's a human chimp.
Well, he's not a human. He's a chimp. It's you know, it's not to be taken as like the reality, but it's like a heightened reality kind of
so,
thing.
So do people spend so much time trying to analyze this thing sometimes that you're like, just roll with it? Because like if you're watching a Broadway show and you're really sitting there looking for the schematic for it all to make sense.
Yeah, well, if you're watching like the I always draw parallels to like the Muppets or something. You don't question why Kermit is with a pig.
Yeah. Right.
It's just supposed to be kind of like something that all the kids in the school, they don't hate him because he's a monkey, they don't care that he's a monkey or chimp or whatever. They don't like him because he's hopelessly optimistic, and that's the opposite of the kids in the school. The kids in the school kind of feed off of people's weaknesses, and they get joy out of other people's pain, and he doesn't see any reason to do that until sort of the end of the story. He's kind of breaking down, he's broken down kind of song by song.
But you've got some heavy stuff in here, and you know, some of it probably was intentional and some of it just fell into place as you were writing this, whether it's obviously burning down a school and fire and, you know, all that stuff and bullying and all of that.
Yeah, it's just sort of snowballed like any other record that we would make. There were discussions that happened once I had written maybe four or five songs and Michael had written four or five songs. But decisions about like plot points were kind of made once we realized that we had something that connected, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Not based on any one element that you felt you had a need to put in there, so to speak.
No, I mean there was just like a need to serve the story, I guess. I think we thought that this sort of dramatic conclusion made sense for him to ultimately find peace in solitude. He had to do something drastic that would cause him to be permanently exiled from the kids he initially wanted to connect with in order for him to find that he didn't need them in the first place.
Hicksville High, Billy Joel, Lorraine Bracco. I mean, were you aware that you were, I mean, by nature, it's where you lived. But were you aware at any point that you were going to a high school that a lot of performers came out of?
Well, I was only really aware of Billy Joel, and everybody kind of was. Like,
because it's pervasive, it's kind of hard not to be.
Yeah, like right. Teachers are telling stories about.
Oh, did they really?
Him. I mean, yeah. There was one teacher I had that would.
It wore like a badge of honor kind of thing?
Kind of, yeah.
I mean, were you aware of any of this stuff that was surrounding you that didn't really necessarily lead to this album, but certainly was in the water? Because there's
a ton
of it.
Do you mean like bullying, or what do you mean?
Well, no, I just mean musically. Like, if you look at Billy Joel, if you were to take Scenes for an Italian Restaurant, right? That 7-minute song, you know, these are storytelling. He was a storyteller. He was a storyteller, and that's what you're doing with this. It's the same sort of thing.
I don't know. I still really haven't had my like Billy Joel phase.
So you weren't aware at all. There wasn't really anything in the water at Hicksville High other than teachers kind of talking about it.
No, not really. I think that if anything, it kind of like kept me away or something because it was so ingrained.
But I mean, having a dad who was able to allow you to record this record, not have to go into a big recording studio to do so. How did you make the decision? Was it again based on the fact that it's the material lent itself to that kind of tone overall?
I think it really had to do with like the archetype that our producer, our first producer, Jonathan Rado, kind of presented to us as like a possibility, you know, under the constraints of like an indie label or whatever. You know, it's like, if you know how to record and or you have a sense of recording, get your own equipment so that you don't have to pay for studio time. And also it's like, if what you like to do is record all the time, you know, get an environment where you don't have to just demo and then do the real record later, you know. Because we would be on tour and then we'd come home for sometimes seven days or like 2 weeks, and we would be recording for the record, you know, the whole time. So we didn't have to not be working on. We didn't have to just like we didn't have to plan. Okay, this is when we're.
I have to be in the studio and I have to book that and all of that. You can just show up and do your thing. Let's talk about Todd, shall we? I mean, obviously, had you heard. And it's interesting because we're sitting here, you know, this many years later, we're sitting here like 42, 43 years later. Had you heard Meatloaf?
Well, my brother had. I've definitely heard Bat Out of Hell, but I haven't gotten into it a lot.
Did you say Todd? I mean, you obviously met him.
Well, we said it. Before we knew what role he would
but that's
play.
What, yeah, that's what
but
I that,
it,
at.
It
yeah.
was it was like first meeting him and then thinking, hey, there's a possibility that he might actually do it. You know, I think the first time we met him, he talked about how he had done like his newest record with a lot of collaborations, and it was then that we kind of thought, oh, well, he's probably like open to featuring on stuff.
And fearless. That's pretty fearless of you guys.
Of him or of...
Because you're talking to Todd, man, you know?
Well,
that's fearless. I mean, it's a good thing to be fearless because that's how you get somewhere, but...
Well, you gotta ask.
When Todd magically becomes part of this project, it's really interesting because I can hear where the Todd is, but that's because I am so damn familiar with all things Todd. But... did you and your brother talk about any parameters? Because now you suddenly have this big guy involved in your thing. So how did you kind of temper what the role was going to be and take it full advantage of all the things he can also do?
Well, first, I mean, it was kind of like first, Michael decided that he didn't feel like he wanted to sing the song Rock Dreams, which is the song that my mother sings.
Yes.
And that came just because the song had been around for a while and he didn't feel like singing it, basically. He did a rough vocal and he was like, I don't want to sing this song. So then we got our mom to sing it and it just seemed like, okay, well now we've cast someone as this character.
So we can open
let's,
it up.
Let's get Todd to sing all of the father's parts.
It's crazy, though.
I did not expect anybody to, you know, I didn't expect anybody to necessarily really listen closely, but it was just important to follow through for the few that felt, you know, that they wanted to do that.
Well,
I thought that it was something that was different about this record to the last record was it was a concept record, so it meant that every lyric kind of had to be able to not just sound good, you know, paired with the music, but it had to make sense.
That's,
you know,
hard work,
it had
though.
It had to, yeah. And now, and that has now translated into our pop songs that we write or our autobiographical songs. It's like we don't just want it to sound good with the music, and we'll rewrite things to make it be able to be communicated to the audience, and we'll try to broaden it so it doesn't just have to do with us, you know, so it can be more of a, you know, more of a universal thing. And that just happened naturally because we spent so much time trying to make sure that the story was not just labeled a musical. It was really one in that, you know, we cared about the audience. Whereas the first record, we didn't think about them at all.
Aside from not having doing these things together, right? Which is more of a brotherly thing that, you know, you have a dynamic. You cut each other off or one doesn't let the other finish. Yeah. But when you're writing, when you're doing the musical stuff, is that the same dynamic?
Not really. Like, there was...
Where's the split?
Well, there were definitely times when I would play Michael a song and I'd say, you know, because of a lyric that kind of spontaneously came a plot point that would affect how he had to write his song or something. Like that, I just wrote this song.
But is so it now really your song and his song, your song and his song?
Yeah, and there's a lot of like kind of...
How does that give and take work? And how does that overlap happen so it actually gets done?
Well, what I liked about it on this record is that there's like, when you get to the end of the record, there's really two completely different ways you can take it, take the story.
His
once
way
it's
or
over.
Your way.
Yeah. Ooh, and it allows for both, which like my way would be kind of like the story ends on sort of a positive note because he is, you know, he realizes the presence of his soul and he realizes that love can come from an outside source.
Unrequited love is possible.
Well, yeah, I guess. Sort of, kind of. Yeah.
Sort of, kind of, not, maybe, possibly.
And then maybe it can also be looked at as a tragic thing because he just ends up alone in the the woods.
Wow. It's an interesting dynamic. I mean, but yet, you think you two are going to be the Beatles and stay together for a long time?
I don't know.
Or is one of you going to be Twig and the other one's going to be Lemon?
I have no idea. We're because we've written lots of songs now, and we don't know whether we're going to
do them solo.
Like we're going to record them together, but we don't know whether or not we're going to sequence them separately. There's kind of like three records that are kind of being worked on now, and it's like one record is definitely both of our songs together, and then it's possible that it'll be one record that's mostly mine and mostly his. But once they're all recorded, there might be a good way to make them all sort of equal. Or the way we write is we allow each other to finish our thoughts and we pepper in information here and there, but it's the same way that we talk. I think if we wrote together, it would kind of be like, you know, we'd be cutting off each other's
must be
flow.
Interesting at the dinner table.
I guess sometimes it is.
So I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich, and it's two of your songs on the outside and songs by others in between.
I move so quickly, I thought I knew nothing but what I had known. Thank you.
said that you were with me. You said you were my friend. Did you really love the city? Or did you just pretend? You said you loved her secrets and her freedoms hid away. She was better than America. That's what I heard you say. You said, how could this happen? You said, how can this be? The remnant of dishonor on a bridge of misery. And we who cried for mercy from the bottom of the pit, was our prayer so damn unworthy? The sun rejected it. So gather up the killer, get everyone in town. Stand me by those pillars, let me take this temple down. The king so kind and solemn, he wears a bloody crown. So stand me by that column, let me take this temple down. Thank you.
Don't wanna know. fire burning in my heart, burning for years and for years. Your love and kisses gave that flame a start. I put it out with my tears. You don't remember, I can't forget. That old affection lives with me yet. I keep on longing to my regret. I know I can't forget. There's a little spark of love still burning and yearning down in my heart for you. There's a longing there for years returning. I want you, I do. So come, come to my heart again. Come, come, set that love aflame. For there's a little spark of love still burning and yearning. I left you laughing when I said goodbye, laughing but nobody knew how much relief I found when I could cry. I cried my heart out for you. I've loved you more than you'll ever know. Though years have passed, I've wanted you so. Bring back the old love, let new love grow. Come back and whisper low. There's a little spark of love still burning and yearning down in my heart for you. There's a longing there for years returning. I want you, I do. So come, come to my heart again. Come, come, let that love aflame. For there's a little spark of love still burning and yearning for you.
From just the other side, nowhere, to this big time lonesome town. They got a lot of ice and snow here, half as cold as all the people I've found. Every way I've tried to go here seemed to bring me down. Seen about enough to know where I belong. I've got a mind to see the headlights shining on that old white line between my heart and home. Sick of spending Sundays wishing they were Mondays, sitting in a park alone. So give my best to anyone who's left, who ever done me any loving way but wrong. Tell them that the pride of just the other side of nowhere's going home. Taking nothing back to show there for these dues I've paid. But the soul I almost sold here and the body I've been giving away, fading from the neon nighttime glow here, heading for the latter day.
just the other side of nowhere, going home. I've got a mind to see the headlight shining on that old white line between my heart and home. Sick of spending Sundays wishing they was Mondays, sitting in a park alone. So give my best to anyone who's left to ever done me any loving we would wrong. Tell them at the pride of just the other side of nowhere's going home. Taking nothing back to show there for these dues I've paid, but the soul I almost sold here and the body I've been given away. Fading from the neon nighttime glow here, heading for the latter day, just the other side of nowhere, going home. Just the other side of nowhere, going home.
Sword, and that made me think of my friend George. He people said the man was 5'6". Sounds like Georgie with his killing stick. Hey bro, what's the word? Talking about my friend George. Hey bro, what's the word? Talking about my friend George. You're talking about my friend George. I knew Georgie since he's 8. I always thought that he was great. And anything that George would do, you know that I would do it too. George liked music and George liked to fight. He worked out in a downtown gym every night. I'd spar with him when work was done. We split lips, but it was all in fun. Hey bro, what's the word? You're talking about my friend George. Hey bro, what's the word? Talking about my friend George. Talking about my friend George. Next thing I hear, George has got this stick. He's using it for more than kicks. I seen him down at Smalley's bar. He was wired up. I tried to calm him down. Avenge yourself, he says to me. Avenge yourself for humanity. Avenge yourself for the weak and the poor. Stick it to these guys right through their heads. No, the fight is my music and the stick is my sword. And you know that I love you, so please don't say a word. Can't you hear the music playing? The anthem, it's my call. And the last I seen of Georgie was he running through the door. I says, hey bro, what's the word? Talking about my friend George. Hey bro, what's the word? You're talking about my friend George. Talking about my friend George.
Well, there it is, the musical sandwich and a conversation with one half of the Lemon Twigs. Thank you, Brian, for taking the time. Michael, maybe someday, you never know. Nonetheless, the musical sandwich from the album Go to School, Never in My Arms. My friend George Lou Reed, Kate and Anna McGarrickle, Heart Like a Wheel. Chris Christopherson, Just the Other Side of Nowhere. There's a Little Spark of Love Still Burning, Henry Burr, Todd Rundgren, also featured, by the way, prominently on Go to School. His track Golden Goose. Kate Bush, Kite. Seems So Long Ago, Nancy Leonard Cohn, and Top Bread in the Sandwich, Lemon Twigs' earlier track, If You Give Enough. If you have any questions, any thoughts, any input, any output, any throughput, any shot put, or just want to put something out there about my conversation with one half of the Lemon Twigs, or maybe both of them, please email me, Dennis@menaceattic.com. MENACEATTIC.com. As is tradition for 780 shows, it's time for hour number two of Just Another Menace Sunday. New melodic rock and roll giant stack. Well, I don't think you can stack digital thingies, but you can stack CDs and vinyl. And we're going to do it right now.